I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Mark Boris, and this is Straight Talk.
One of the greatest records in terms of the fight game of any Australian ever.
Hey.
Ever.
Take your mind off the possibly 100,000 people that you're competing in front of. The bell rings and then it's go time now. My whole life, I just wanted to be a fighter.
Charming part of the fight.
You were more about the romance of the fight game.
Oh, for sure. I wanted to be that guy that came in and saved the day while protecting my family and my parents. I remember being a little kid living on horse farms, isolated, being an only child. And Dad told me that he had two amateur boxing fights, and I just thought he was a superhero. Just out of the blue, Dad goes, "Let's jump in the car, son. We'll go buy some boxing gloves." We pushed the chairs out of the lounge room, and that became our new sparring room. Just as I was about to start winning, that Dad really announced his retirement. He was like, "You're doing well. You keep at it." So that just kept me on that path then. So I don't want to have the story where I could have and I didn't. The only thing that mattered to me was becoming a world champ.
So all up, what have you got, 150?
149.
Oh, okay, 149 bouts. That's crazy.
I wish I had 149 more. Oh, I missed it so bad. This is the hardest part about being retired, because for 35 years, I've only had one focus. And then all of a sudden, that whole goal and that whole dream is just stops.
It's an absolute honour to be a martial artist for the last 35 years.
Yes, it's so hard.
Feel as though then the next phase of your life is about inspiring and motivating others.
Yeah, with my kids, it makes me so proud to see them achieve their own martial arts dreams.
I'm really excited about this. John Wayne Parr, welcome to Straight Talk, mate.
Mate, thank you so much. This is an absolute pleasure to be here. It's so surreal to be in the studio and face-to-face.
It's surreal for me as a fight fan, but a mad fight fan. But it's probably, from my point of view, it's more surreal for me to be sitting in front of probably one of Australia's greatest exponents of the fight game, whether it be boxing, well, particularly Muay Thai, kickboxing, etc. I mean, most people don't know, which kills me, which is why I want to talk to you, that you probably would hold one of the greatest records in terms of the fight game of any Australian ever.
Hey.
Ever. And no one ever talks about it. So, JWP. So, let's just, first and foremost, were you always a Queenslander?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, no. I was actually born on the border in Albury.
The Albury boy.
Yeah, Albury. So my parents were horse trainers.
Yeah.
So my mum was a jockey. My dad was a jockey. My dad was a leading jockey in Albury at the time when I was born. And then I remember being a little kid living on horse farms, isolated, being an only child. And Dad told me that he had two amateur boxing fights, and I just thought he was a superhero. My dad was I didn't see him compete, but just the fact that he told me he boxed, it's like, wow. And then being influenced by the TV and seeing Monkey Magic. And I remember when I was a bit younger, the movie Karate Kid came out.
The Karate Kid?
Yeah. And because I moved a lot as a kid, I ended up going to 11 different schools growing up. And then the story of the Karate Kid was the kid starting school and being isolated and having to start fresh. And then I could relate to him because I was always a new kid going to all these different new schools. And then martial arts was his a savior to give him, keep him a direction. So yeah, I could definitely relate. And then my whole life, I just wanted to be a fighter of some sort.
Really?
Whether it be boxing, karate, taekwondo, I just wanted to fight. Rock and roll wrestling, Hulk Hogan, long as I was competing, yeah, that's all I wanted to do. And then we'd move around. And then at the age of 11, we finally moved to Brisbane and we're sort of in the suburbia. And then a friend of us told us there was a taekwondo school near our house. It was walking distance. And it was a little bit late at night. My parents gave me the permission to go out at night and go four streets down the road to the karate hall. And then, that's when the the obsession began. I started when I was 11.
11 years old. So 11 years of age, you're going to down to a taekwondo place, a gym.
Yep. Yes.
And Brisbane's a pretty safe joint, relatively speaking, especially back then.
Yes.
What year was that now?
'80s. Yeah, for sure. '87, actually.
'87, okay.
It's so right before Expo. Remember Expo?
I do remember that, before the Brisbane Expo. So you're here's a kid excited about the sort of romance of what TV shows were showing us in those days about fighting, but as opposed to having to learn to fight. Because it's not as if what you're saying to me, I guess, is that you weren't a kid who was living on the streets who had to learn how to defend himself. You're not like Mark Hunt, for example, who's got to defend for his life.
Yes.
Having dreadful upbringing. You were more about the romance of the fight game.
Oh, for sure.
That's mad.
The idea of seeing people that aren't strong and having that protector. I wanted to be that guy that came in and saved the day if anything went wrong, or protecting my family and my parents. Or I always thought martial arts was a way of being that guy that stood out from the crowd. Like you said, the romance with being a fighter. It was very cool. I remember walking to the hall for the first time and seeing everyone in their gis, and then they're all punching and counting in Korean, ja, ja, and I'm like, this is real. And then we did our first class, and I was out the back just swinging away, just trying to be somebody. And then from the first class, like, this is me, I'm done. I want to do this forever. And then about two or three sessions in, mum and dad seen that I had a passion for it, so I got my first gi. And then the idea of staying in front of the class and hearing the geese snap when you do your punches in the air, it was so crazy. It was so cool.
Did you go through all the belts? Because taekwondo is very formulated.
Yes.
You got to do these 10 moves and you get your yellow belt. Then you do these 10 moves, you get your blah, blah. Did you go through all that process?
I went through about three gradings.
Yeah. Think to yourself that, what the fuck is going on? Did you end up sparring with that?
I went into one competition for the Queensland titles when I was 10. And then it was at at the QE2. So I had to have three fights in one day. I won my first two, got to the final. I fought a kid that was a little bit older than me. Just got beat, but I got a silver medal. And then I remember just putting them around my neck, just singing, I've made it. I've got a silver. This is crazy. Went home and So at the end of the day, they had like a grading and people were breaking boards. And then that just even blew my mind even more. And then I watched them break all these boards. And then the trainer called me up and then he said, you want to have a go? And I was like, I don't think I can. And he talked me into it. You can do it. Just put my positive mindset, punch through the board. So I did the 1, 2, 3, and I broke through it. And I thought, I'm awesome. So I took half of the board home with me. And then I got home and I said to Dad, hold this board. I want it. And then not knowing that there's a certain design for the board. So Dad's held it and I've gone through the same motions. 1, 2, and I've tried it. And I think I ended up breaking my knuckles more. But yeah, I thought I was a man. But yeah, that quickly brought me back to reality.
So it's not as if you're a kid getting picked on, because you're a middleweight. You fought as a boxing
middleweight. I was small growing up.
Were you?
Yeah, but always a new kid. Every time I just get a set of friends, mum and dad would sit me down. Oh, it's time to move again, time to go interstate. Or I was always going interstate and always the new kid. So just as I just started to get a group of guys, then it's time to go. So I think that's what helped me later on in life when I had moved overseas to Thailand, because I was always new and able to make friends easily and customized to different locations, that I was just I could stay there for long term without having to get homesick because I didn't have a home.
Yeah, we're used to it.
Yeah.
Have a one place. Well, can you take me to the part where you moved away from taekwondo, for example, and started doing, say, kickboxing, Muay Thai? What was the next step in your career chase, the thing you chased?
Yeah, so we did taekwondo for about a year and a half, and I was just set this was going to be my life from here on in. And then, unfortunately, the taekwondo school numbers started to drop down and they couldn't afford their rent anymore. So eventually we went in the class one night and the instructor said, got us all to sit down. Said, unfortunately, this is our last class. We have to move to a different location. And then I was devastated because I didn't know what I was going to do. And I'm lucky for me, kickboxing ended up moving into the same hall a few months after the taekwondo left. And I thought, it's not taekwondo. I'll do this as an activity until I find another taekwondo school. And then, we did that first kickboxing class, and then all of a sudden guys are in shorts and singlets and they're wearing boxing gloves and they're hitting pads. Because in Taekwondo, we're just punching in the air. We never had any contact, really. And then the idea of sparring, it's like, whoa. And then, that just completely changed my mindset. And it's like, all right, I want to be a kickboxer now. And then just so happened the movie Kickboxer with Van Damme came out right at the same time as I started kickboxing. I thought, how good is this? Because being Taekwondo, wanted to go to Korea, and now Van Damme's going to Thailand, and he's fighting the most scariest guys. I'm like, this is me. I want to go to Thailand. I want to be this guy. So, and then for the next 20 years, Van Damme was my go-to. Every time I got stuck, what would Van Damme do? He'd stay the course. So that just kept me on that path then. So, and then I always wanted to tell myself, no distractions. I was working in kitchens, trying to get by in high school, on the weekends, and you'd always hear the different chefs and waiters and stuff always say, oh, I could have been this, but I got so far and then I stopped because of the wife or the job or the location. So I don't want to be one of you guys. I don't want to have the story where I could have and I didn't. I'm not going to let work, girlfriends, and location stop me from achieving what I want to achieve. And that was my mindset from like 11. So I'm very lucky to stick to it and accomplish what I want to accomplish.
So when you said you don't want to let anything distract you from achieving what you want to achieve, did you actually have in your mind, I want to become a world champion? I mean, what did you want to achieve? What did you want to become in the movies? Or
World champion. The only thing that mattered to me was becoming a world champ. So my mum forgets this conversation, but when I was about, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks in the kickboxing, I was sparring, and I was sparring the adults, and I was a kid, and I was holding my own, and I come home to see mum, and she's in bed getting ready to sleep. Mum, I did really well. I think I can be a world champion one day. And she laughed. Oh, that's so cute. Oh, that's good. You got a dream and just mocked me. And then she didn't know, but I held it to her in like 20 years. And then when I finally did win my first world title, I said, see, mum, I told her. And she goes, I have no idea what you're talking about. But I had this grudge all the time and she didn't even know.
But she inspired you. She didn't know.
Yeah, she was
motivated.
Yeah. Every time, I'm going to prove you wrong.
Can you tell me the first time you went to do Muay Thai in Thailand and you moved to Thailand? Can you take me through that?
Yeah, it was terrifying. So I was a 19-year-old kid. I'd won about 5 fights in a row in Australia. I won my first Australian title at 17, and then I won the South Pacific title at 19. And the South Pacific title was really tough. I got dropped in the second round with leg kicks. And then I held on super tight for the round 3 and 4. And then the last round, I needed to knock out the win. And I have a Thai sponsor that's got a restaurant in Broadbeach called Boon Chew. And then he came up in the corner and grabbed me by the top of the hair. And he's like, come on, you need to knock this guy out. You're gonna lose. And internally, I started like crying emotionally, going, oh, God, I don't want to let Richard down. He's helped me so much. I feel so bad. I'm losing. And then ended up going out in the last round and scoring the knockout with 30 seconds to go. I won the South Pacific title. And then the next day, I took the belt down to the restaurant. Richard, we did it. We did it without your help. Thank you so much for everything you've done for me. And then he goes, last night you showed a lot of heart. I believe you have the potential to go all the way. How would you like to go to Thailand and learn from the best? I'd love to go to Thailand. He said, I'll tell you what I do. If you can organize your passport, I'll do the rest. Okay, so I went down to the post office, sent away for the passport. Passport comes about a week later. Go down the street. Hey, Richard, my passport came. He grabs me by the hand. We walk down another couple hundred meters down from the shop to the travel agent. I want a 6-month ticket to Thailand, please, open ticket. He said, you got to promise me 6 months. If you can last 6 months in Thailand, you'll make me very proud. If you go for 1 week, 1 month, you'll get there trained, but then it's not going to really sink in. So if you go 6 months long term, then you'll create muscle memory and then you'll be able to bring that technique back. Oh, yeah, for sure. So so Richard's family was leaving at the same time. So I went with his brother, his wife, and their daughter. So flew to Thailand. We drove to the where Richard's brother was staying. I get introduced to everyone. And then the family I went with, they say, oh, we're going to go now, see ya. So I'm left with all these strangers and they can't speak English. I can't speak Thai. And then we go upstairs and the brother, he shows me the double bed. He said, oh, we share. So for 3 months, I had to share this double bed with this Richard's brother who couldn't speak English. So we had everything was hand signals. So hungry, sleepy, training. So I end up staying at a gym called Sijutong, and then trained there for ages.
Whereabouts
and,
in Thailand?
This was Pattaya.
Pattaya.
So the only thing was it was a very westernized gym. They had no gyms in Thailand really wanted to accept foreigners back in the 90s because they were worried that the Westerners were going to come in, learn their sport, then start beating them at their own game. And then Thais are very proud of the Muay Thai and their heritage. So all the camps like, no Westerner, no Westerner. But Sijutong had open arms. So I went there, trains. But the only thing was there was like, say, 40 Westerners. And then it was like a factory. So everyone would go for a week, come through. A week later, they'd leave and the new Westerners come. So they weren't getting any sort of love from the trainers. Everyone was just like a factory. So 3 rounds on the bag for 25 rounds and then you're done. It's like, I could do this at home. What am I doing? So they finally get me a fight about 3 months in. It's very tough. End up winning by a knockout in the fourth. And then the superstar of Thailand at the time, his name was Sangtanui. It means the small candlelight flame. He came to Australia to fight and he met my sponsor. And then
Richard.
Richard, yes. Yep. Richard met Sangtan. And then Richard begged them, hey, can John Wayne come and train with you guys, please? He's not very happy where he is. And we don't want Westerners. We don't want Westerners. And then Richard begged them so much that they finally accepted. It's all right, fine. So when they got back to Thailand, they came and picked me up. They took me to the camp. And now I'm in Bangkok. And now everything's changed. So now imagine all of Brisbane and you're the only white guy. It was like, wow. And then they take me to the camp. And then we don't have he shows me the toilet. There's no toilet. It's just a squat toilet, a porcelain squat toilet. And there's no toilet paper. So there's a big basin with a blue tub sitting on top of the water. And you use the tub to pour in water into your hand to wipe your bottom. And then there's no shower. So you use that same blue tub to stand on the concrete, wet your body, lather up on soap. Then you use to rinse off. And then with the same blue tub, you use that to pour water in your mouth after you brush your teeth. And you're sharing that one blue tub with 10 different boxers in the room and they're all brushing their teeth, pooping, showering.
All Thai guys.
All Muay Thai guys. So, and then we go upstairs and it's just an empty room. And then you sleep side by side on the wooden floor next to the other fighters. So, oh, this is a bed. Oh, I sleep next to the ball. So I only got one guy beside me instead of having two guys beside me. So I sleep beside the wall and then with no table or chairs for food. So we've got to sit cross-legged on the wooden floor to have our rice and have our meals. And say when the food comes out, you get 4 or 5 different dishes in the center. Everyone gets a plate of rice and then everyone goes one spoonful at a time. So a little spoonful of rice. And then it's like a community sharing. You can't just pig out and say, this is mine. And then yes, no girls either. So it's 10 dudes. 24/7, just waking up, training, eating, a little naps during the day, training again. And then after your fight, you're allowed 7 days off. So jump on a bus, go to Pattaya for a 3-hour bus ride, be a Westerner for 7 days, speak English, might have a hamburger, sneaky little hamburger, and then jump back on the bus and be a Thai again. So yeah, it was such a life-changing opportunity. And then my Thai trainer said, I don't want to teach you Thai boxing, I want to teach you to be Thai. Our culture, our everything. So learning how to be polite and how the older generation is very important. Always be respectful, always why first and always instigate first. They're helping people. And so that during my career, I was very lucky with people always commenting, you're so polite, why are you so polite? Because I lived in a country where everyone was a killer. So you got to be very polite. You definitely use your please and thank yous when you know every single person can knock you out.
What is it about Muay Thai? Culturally, it's very important in Thailand.
Oh, for sure.
Can you share with me perhaps why it's so culturally important? I mean, it's not just a sport. It's more than that. I mean, I've been to them and it's rituals and people just love it. Like, it's not like if I go to a boxing match here, the Blake next, you might know a couple of people, and you watch a couple of fighters, you might know. But there is it's like lifestyle.
Oh,
and it's extraordinarily important. It's a bit like sumo in Japan, nearly. It's up there. Yes. Well, what is that about it? I mean, how does it fit into the Thai life?
It's a national sport. So we play football and rugby. And over there, they're Thai box. So there's there's stadiums all over the country. They got massive stadiums in Bangkok, and they got the smaller stadiums on the outskirts. They got temple events, and then it's an opportunity for people to survive. So in our camp, for instance, we'd be resting during the day, hear a knock on the gate, and there'd be parents with a seven-year-old son, and then the manager would come out, and their parents would plead their case. Oh, look, we've got five kids. We can't afford to keep them all. Would you please accept our son into your camp to be a fighter? And then the trainer will look him up and down and feel his little arms. Okay, yeah, sure, you can be one of us. So then the parents will hand him his little backpack, and he'll give his parents a wire, a little hug. And then the parents will walk away, and the next minute that seven-year-old becomes property of the camp from here on in. And then from that moment, the fighters become his family. So then the first week he'll cry his eye out because he's separation from his parents. And we've got to try and calm him down. That's okay, little buddy, we're your family now. And then we've got to show him how to run, how to hold his hands up, and show him how to hit the pads. And then he's got to become a man from that moment forward. And now he has to fight to make prize money to survive off whatever he can make. So within, say, a month or so, he's competing for the first time, and that fear of having to compete. And then if he becomes a superstar, like he can make 10 times the average wage compared to someone working on a regular job. So the potential there to make a lifestyle is up to the child. And once they start, everyone has a passion for it. They start collecting the magazines, and they start putting the posters on the wall, start having heroes to emulate. And yeah, it's really cool that violence is the answer.
It's a way out.
So on the flip side, though, if you're a girl, yeah, boys go to fighting, the girls go to the other side, the dark side. And it's so much better to be a boy in Thailand than to be a girl.
Is that right? Does Muay Thai go for girls?
It does now.
Yeah.
But when I was there, girls were considered not equal. And then there'd even be signs at the stadiums, please, no females leaning against the ring, because they were scared that they give the bad juju. The guys would get cut from elbows and stuff because the girls had touched the ring and infected it with
crazy. Bad luck.
Girls couldn't fight whatsoever. They couldn't lean against the ring, no ring card girls. And it's only from about the year 2000 that they started going, okay, there's an interest here. So instead of having the one ring, we'll have two rings. So one ring for the boys, one ring for the girls. And then eventually they say, well, we can't do that. That's unethical. So we'll have the boys fight first and the girls fight last in case the girls infect the ring. And then they got the stage where it's like, oh, no one's getting. So we'll just make it a normal part. Now the females are more popular than the males. It's so bizarre how the whole country's turned a leaf. But yeah, for a while there, they were so sexist and everything else. But
I remember many, many years ago, the first time I went to a Muay Thai competition in Bangkok, it wasn't just the fighters. They had young kids, little boy it was, a young boy, he was 10, 11, charming a snake, like a cobra in the middle of the ring between fights.
Oh, yep.
Like it's a full entertainment thing, and it's nearly a religious experience, like, you know, the way everybody... you know, they wear the band around their head and, you know, they address each other really fully well-mannered and respectful. It's nearly it's nearly ritualistic in a lot of ways, just including the way you dress.
Yes.
I mean, what's that all about?
So the headpiece is called a monkon, and then we have our papa jets, which go on the arm. And then there was a gentleman that got captured by the Cambodians, I think it was that captured him. And then... they make people fight to the death, and he ended up having 9 fights in a row, and he won all 9. And then the king said, I'm going to allow you your freedom. And when he came back to Thailand again, he was considered a hero. And then the sport of Muay Thai was suddenly the king's suggested that we're going to change our army, our police, our all our, and to learn this art to protect the country. And then when he was faced with death, he put the monkon on like a sacred piece, probably from his family or something. And then he's asking permission from the gods. So I was always taught to ask for permission from the earth, the wind, the fire, the water, and your god of choice. And then you do three bows. The first one's for the gods, and the second one is for your family, your mother, father, past relatives. And then the third one is for your training partners, pad holders, aspiring, everyone that's helped you get to that right moment in time. Without them, you wouldn't be there. So you ask them permission, and then you start like the dance as a stretch and a warm up, and so take your mind off the possibly 100,000 people that you're competing in front of. And then when you sort of come out of your trance, all right, it's go time now. You're ready to rock and roll. And then the bell rings, and then off you go. So hopefully the little dancers give you some good protection in between.
Do you remember your first fight, Muay Thai fight?
Yes, for sure. I was 14 years old.
14?
Yes, 14. So I had my first taekwondo fight at 11, and then, my first kickboxing fight. I was in year 10, and it was on a Thursday night. So it was a super tough fight. I got leg kicked to death, went to a very close points. I just got beat. But the next day I had at school, and a little black eye and a bruised leg. And I remember hobbling around school, "What's wrong with you?" "Oh, I had a kickboxing fight." And then watching everyone's expression of me change. All of a sudden, I was a new kid and always a bit of a loner. All of a sudden, I had respect from the older kids, and even the teacher was like, you've like become a man now almost overnight. I just always being the new kid. All of a sudden, I had like this, oh shit, people respect me now. I like this. And then, even though I lost, I told mum that night when I got home, this is me. I want to be a fighter forever. I just loved everything about it. Even though I lost the walkout, the crossing the ropes, even though I lost the fight, I've come out of the ring and I was walking back towards the dressing room. Someone in the crowd goes, "Way to go, Wayne!" And the whole crowd gave me like an ovation, and I felt like I was walking on a cloud back to the. And I was and that was that moment. That's what got me, was that part of being accepted by the whole room. It's just like I felt like just special.
It sounds like to me, like especially in the early days, probably the later days too. But it sounds like the fight game energized you.
Oh, for sure.
Like it gave you
acceptance.
Yeah, acceptance. But it gave you a massive sort of energy and nearly a gratitude towards what it provided you.
Oh, for sure. And then having my dad there as well, that was a big part of it. So when I first started kickboxing, so been about a year or so, and one weekend, just out of the blue, they goes, "Let's jump in the car, son. We'll go buy some boxing gloves." So we jump in the car, we go to like a Sporties, we get two pairs of tins, no mouthpiece or nothing, we get back to home. We pushed the chairs out of the lounge room, and that became our new sparring room. So mum would be the referee. Mum would count the time. So we, and then dad used to punch the shit out of me. He'd give me a little jab. "Stop leaving with the head, son. Papa, stop leaving with the head. Bah." And then I had no idea what I was doing. And then after about a year or so, eventually I just started getting on top of dad. And then it was just as I was about to start winning that dad really announced his retirement. It was like, "Come on, I'm just like, oh no, I'm done now. You're doing well, you're doing good, you keep at it."
So Richard sent you off to a camp, and you've been finally accepted to go into a Thai camp.
Yes.
And you're living there, and you did your stint there. You had your first Muay Thai fight. I tried to look through your record. Like it goes for pages and pages and pages. How many professional Thai fights did you have?
149. Oh, no, sorry, 135. And I had 14 pro boxing.
Yeah, so we'll park the boxing for a moment. Yep. Just put that over the side there because you fought one of my mates, Nader.
Yes.
We'll just put boxing aside for that. But in Muay Thai, you had 135 fights.
Yes.
How many world titles did John Wayne Parr achieve?
10.
10 world titles.
10 world titles.
10 world titles. And how many times did you defend your world titles?
I only defended one. That was in Japan. So
this is Muay Thai world titles?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah,
so you achieved 10 Muay Thai world champions?
Yes.
World championship. They're in different weight divisions? How was it?
Mainly 10? Middle. Between 70, 72 and a half.
Yeah. So, and then can we just flip over to kickboxing? So I don't think you got a world title for kickboxing. You got in the finals, or you're very close to world title. So just take me on the kickboxing. What did you do there?
It's K1.
K1,
there's a massive organization in Tokyo.
Yep.
I fought an eliminator in Melbourne. It was an 8-man tournament. I had the fight 3 times in one night. So I fought a gentleman. I knocked out my first 2 opponents, and then in the final, I fought a gentleman called Michael Zambides.
Yep, he was a very famous
Greek superstar. Yeah, he was a household name. He was coming to Australia regularly, beating all our guys.
He lives in Greece now.
Yeah. He was on Dancing with the Stars in Greece, yeah. And that really lifted his profile to superstar level.
So you're the same weight as Zambides?
Yes.
Wow. Have you seen him lately? He looks, he's unbelievably cut. I've seen him on the back of boats and stuff like that, but I follow him on Instagram. But so you thought, he was a legend.
Yes. Oh, for sure.
So K1, Japan, we've had some great Australians fight there in K1. I think Peter Graham, Chief, Mark Hunt.
Yep.
I think Adam Watt.
Adam Watt, yes.
Yeah, as well.
I've seen Adam Watt fight in Vegas as well. Yeah. I went to the K1 in Vegas and went to watch him.
I'm not sure either one or two of those might have won the world title. I think Adam might have won the world title. Mark Hunt did. Okay. So you fought kickboxing. I don't know how many fights you had in kickboxing. How many fights do you remember?
About maybe 10-ish.
Yeah, okay. So 10 fights, and you had 14 pro fights, boxing fights here in Australia.
Yep.
So all up, what have you got, 150 bouts?
149.
Oh, okay, 149 bouts.
Yep.
That's crazy.
I wish I had 149 more.
You would like to?
Oh, I miss it so bad.
What's one of your greatest battles in Muay Thai in the world title? So can you just, because you had some very famous ones, the names of the people who are Thai guys, which I can never pronounce or remember, but just take me through some of them that sit in your memory.
Yeah, my two greatest ones are my Thailand world titles. To go to Thailand and compete in Muay Thai against the Thai in front of a Thai crowd was absolutely mind-blowing. So my first one is a promotion called the King's Birthday, King of Thailand Celebration. It's in an open. Have you ever seen the movie Kickboxer with Van Damme?
Yep.
So at the very start, they're hitting pads and they're in a park. So it was that very park that
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
It comes to celebrate the King's birthday with over 100,000 people come to this we sing the birthday song and fireworks going off and all these festivities. And then, I fought on it 97 and 99.
What, 97, 99, what?
So 97, I fought on the King's birthday. Yeah. And then I lost because I'd never fought 100,000 people before and just a little bit too anxious and gassed out a little bit in the last round.
Can we stop you there for a sec?
Yep.
Because that's really important. I'd like to know a little bit about that from your point of view. Maybe explain to listeners the significance of what that means. I mean, when there's a crowd of 100,000 people, which you're not used to, and your adrenaline starts to go hard, especially before the fight starts, how that affects your gas tank, how that affects your tank. I mean, what is it when you say you gassed out? I mean, it's not that you're not fit. You would have been super fit.
Yes.
But maybe explain what the adrenaline does to you and, the effect it has on you in terms of making you gas.
Yep. So, 97, I'd just been picked up by the number one promoter in Thailand. So, my first fight was in front of 40,000 people in an open park in the outside of Thailand, outside Bangkok, sorry. And then my second fight was in front of 60,000. So, I thought I had the crowd down I thought I could handle the pressure. And then when I got invited to the fight on the King's birthday, we'd have to park the car half an hour from the park and walk through the crowd of shoulder to shoulder for what it seemed like an hour. And then finally get to the tent. And like I said, I've never seen so many people in one place before. And then when it was time to go to the ring, we had to get a police escort to get us through the crowd to try and push people out of the way. And that in itself was like terrifying. And then being the white guy going through all the crowd and get onto the ring and then to look out, and it was as ocean. Like, as far as you could see, it was just people, you know, 360, wherever you looked.
And what then, does it do to you?
My legs went great, because when you do the starting the dance, my legs went weak. It's like, oh no, this isn't a good time for this to happen. And then I started the fight a little bit too fast. So, and then by the time I got to the fifth round, I was just a little bit fatigued and fell over a few times, just cost me points. So, and then the second time that I got invited to the fight in 99, I was supposed to fight 98 as well, but so in Thailand, if you stay at one camp for so many fights, they own you. And then once you start building a name, if someone comes along and they want to buy the right, so let's say I'm John Wayne Boonshu, and you come along, you're John Wayne, you want me to change my name to Kmart, John Wayne Kmart. All right, I'll give you $1 million if you change your last name so you represent us.
So your transfer fee.
Yeah, like a transfer. So so I was at this camp for so long, and then we had a big falling out, and I ran away and went to a different camp. And then the owner of that camp, the day of the fight in 98, he went on the national news saying, if John Wayne Parr fights tonight, I'm going to take the promoter to court because he can't allow him to fight without my permission first. So then I had the, as I'm taking my shirt off the fight, all right, John Wayne, don't worry about taking your shirt off. You're not competing. So I missed out 98. And then 99, because I remember walking out that first time and pooping my pants. So this time I'm going to visually get myself into the zone. So I'm going to walk out. So as I walk out, they've got a stage now. So you walk up on top of the stage and now you can see 100,000 people. And then just trying to tell myself, take a big breath, absorb it all. How many times you get to do this in your life? Just love it. And then walking down the runway and then doing the dance and looking out into the crowd in between. It was just, yeah, it was magical. And then ended up having the greatest fight ever. So another little story. So Rich's brother had only just died of AIDS like a week before my fight. So that was the main reason I was there. Since I was there, to go to the funeral and to be part of the all that part, the
grieving.
I said, well, since I'm here, can I fight on the king's birthday? But I said, yeah, of course. So I end up doing that, end up winning, having a greater fight. And then I believe the spirit of Rich's brother helped me that night, because I asked him when I was doing my dance, oh, please, this is my time. If you can, I've come all this way. Can you please give me a little bit of protection during my fight? And then having a great fight. So then the next year I got invited back again. And this is when I was just supposed to fight a normal Thai. And then I was supposed to fight an orthodox fighter. So I get to the weigh-in, and then Songchai, the promoter, he's like, oh, look, bit of bad news. We've got this Masato, who's supposed to fight for the world title tomorrow, Japanese versus the Thai champion. And he doesn't want to fight the Thai because he's scared the Thai has hepatitis. Since he doesn't want to fight him, do you want to fight for the world title tomorrow instead? And I already fought this guy once before. He was a southpaw, and he was the most painfulest fight I've ever fought. He cut me 21 stitches, 2 cuts. And training for 6 weeks for an orthodox fighter, and the change to a southpaw in 24 hours notice. I was like, So I rang my trainer. He goes, this is perfect. What an opportunity. I've got a game plan. I'll tell you tomorrow. Tomorrow? Yeah, now I'll let you sleep tonight, and then we'll work on the game plan in the morning. I was like, sure. So, we go to sleep that night. Can't sleep. Terrified. Don't want to fight this guy. I'm pooping my pants. And I wake up in the morning and I see the trainer. It's like, Sangtan, what's this magical game plan? All right, so because he's southpaw, I think you should fight southpaw tomorrow.
Oh, you changed stance?
He wanted me to change stance. It's like, what? It's like, no, you don't understand. Do you want to do a demo? Is that okay?
Yeah.
So if you stand orthodox and if I stand orthodox and he throws a southpaw, that elbow's going to go straight through the sleep. But if I stand southpaw, now all of a sudden my lean hand's going to protect from that side where he's going to attack me from. That makes sense, but yeah, it's so scary.
That would have confused him too, because he probably used to fight in southpaws.
Yeah. So got out there and I said, I was just having this massive war with myself for the whole time after that, going, I don't know if I can do this. And then, got out there and I thought, I'll stay southpaw the first round, see how it goes. And then if it's no good, I'll just change my rules. And then the first round came and went and I was winning. The second round, I'm winning. And then end up winning all five rounds. And then I took his world title off him in front of 100,000 people live on Thai TV. Yeah, it was such a magical moment. And then, got back to Australia. And then, I got presented the belt in front of all the people. I get back to the change room. And then the one of the workers from the promotion comes up. Hey, I've come to grab that belt. And then my trainer had to explain, hey, if you want the belt, you got to order it. They put your name on it, but you got to pay for it yourself. That's just a presentation belt. It's like, oh, no. So that sucked. But I ended up ordering one, so that was okay. And then that was 2000. And then 2004, I get a email from the promoter. At this stage, I'm back in Australia. I've opened my own gym. I'm married.
This is one on the Gold Coast.
Yeah, I'm married. I've got a little kid now. I've got little Jasmine. And then the opportunity, this is an eight-man tournament. It's a world title, $1 million baht, which is about 40,000 Australian, and a trophy from the Prime Minister of Thailand. And then the deal was you get 100,000 baht to enter the competition, and if you win, it's $1 million baht. That sounds amazing. So I went to Thailand 4 weeks before the event, trained right up, and then... day of the fight, my wife and my baby, Jasmine, arrived to come and cheer me from the stadium. And then the first fight, I fought a Russian where I beat him on points. The second fight, I fought a gentleman from France who was a superstar at the time, and I was lucky to stop him in the third. And then in the final, it was a Thai that had previously beat me 3 times in a row. I'd never beaten this guy, and then here he was again. It's not this guy. And he was a southpaw too. And then... this time for some reason, luck was on my side, and I outworked him, outpaced him, and then beat him every round as well. So I ended up winning the $1 million baht, the trophy from the Prime Minister, and because it was live on TV, and it was the biggest prize money ever given at that stage. The next day, walking through Bangkok, I had taxis like screeching to a stop to jump out and ask for photos. Tuk-tuk drivers to be accepted by the Thais as a champion for the first time was just simply in my head I was like, this is the dream. I've actually achieved the whole purpose of being here, and it's finally happening. So yeah, it took 8 years to get there, but I finally went from fighting for $30 in the small stadiums to all the way to winning $1 million baht and getting a world title. So. It was definitely the cherry on top of all the experiences.
And can I just take you to your decision to go and box, pro boxing?
Yes.
So what drove that decision here in Australia, for example?
So in 98, I just got back from Thailand, and then a friend of mine, Brad Vicali, who's a big referee here in Australia, he rang me up saying, hey, there's a boxing promotion in a week's time. They're looking for someone your weight. I know you haven't boxed before, but they're offering 100 a round. So 4 rounds is $400. Like, really? I'm in. So I went in there and then put the shoes on for the first time. I'd done lots of boxing sparring in Muay Thai, but never professionally. And then the first round, thinking it was going to be similar. Yeah, it was completely different. My opponent, Jimmy Shannon, he was up on his toes and he's bouncing around. He's popping me with jabs and he's moving, using the whole ring. I'm sort of plodding around and trying to chase him, and I couldn't hit him. And then I come back into the first round, and my trainer's like, what are you doing? Stop waiting. Be first. Be aggressive. Just go. And then once he said that, that changed the whole thing, and then I just went to them and ended up stopping him halfway through the second. And then about a week later, Brad Vicali rings me again. Hey, there's a boxing event in another week's time. 400 a round once again. 100 a round once again, 4 rounders, another $400. Went out there and then took that same mindset and knocked the guy out in the first round. And this gave me, now I've got $800. So that gave me another spending money to go back to Thailand for another 12 months. So I lived off that $800 and lived off my prize money once I arrived in Thailand. So then I didn't think of boxing as a career at all. It was mainly just to make money so I'd get to Thailand. And then 2001, I formed a pretty special relationship with a gentleman called Paul Briggs.
Ex-boxer?
Yeah. He was Muay Thai guy first. He was a world champion of Muay Thai and a hero of mine growing up. And then he went to boxing. And then watching him achieve so many things. Here I was, Thailand, and I couldn't get a sponsor. I couldn't get – no one had any interest in Muay Thai whatsoever. And then my friend Paul, all of a sudden he had – guys giving him cars to drive and here's this and here's a wage, I'll put you on. And it's like,
what's
boxing? West Australian.
Just, yeah, yeah,
boxing.
Yeah,
no. Sydney bloke, Paul Briggs, wasn't he? From Sydney?
No, he's Brisbane.
Brisbane boy, yeah.
Yeah, Brisbane. But yeah, just the opportunities that he was given just because he was doing a different form of fighting. Oh, I want what he's having. If he's getting all this stuff, I can do this. So I ended up joining him with Rod Waterhouse. And then got picked up by a boxing promoter called Bill Morty, who was doing the Fox Sports shows back at the time. And then once he signed me, I ended up having like 9 fights in a year, all on Fox Sports.
Wow.
He really pumped my profile really fast. And by my 7th fight, I won the Australian title. And and then that's when I fought Nader.
Yeah, Nader Hamden. So you were fighting middleweight, were you?
Middleweight. Between the both.
Yeah. Okay. So and of course Jeff Fenwick was Nader's coach. How'd that go?
So this is the crazy one. So I was supposed to fight a gentleman from Pakistan, Abdul Rashid. So I fly on down to Sydney to fight a 6 rounder. So I get to the Sydney airport, and then one of the gentlemen from the promotions there to pick me up. So bit of bad news. Nader Hamden's opponent's pulled out. So instead of fighting Abdul tomorrow, instead of fighting 6 rounds, do you want to fight 12 rounds for the IBF Pan Pacific title against Nader? We'll offer you, I was supposed to make 4,000. We'll give you 5 grand. My God.
12 rounds.
This is crazy. 5 grand. I've never made five. The most I ever made was like 1,500. So to make 5 grand, like this was crazy. So I've accepted the 12 rounds. I trained hard. I trusted my cardio. And then, the first 6 rounds was pretty competitive. Nader was probably a little bit on top. And then just a couple of rounds, I was switching my stance a little bit here and there. And then I sat down for the end of the 6. Everyone said, go Southpaw. You see, every time you go Southpaw, it seemed to confuse him a little bit. So I think it's more better if you go Southpaw. So for the next 6 rounds, the last 6, I went Southpaw. And then I believe I was just getting the little bit more of an edge every round. And then at the end of the 12 rounds, they've ordinated the decision. And then Andy Raymond came over to interview us both. So he interviewed Nader first. And in a tough fight, there's about 3,000 people there. And then the crowd booed Nader so bad when he was trying to give an acceptance speech. I felt really bad for him. I felt so bad. And then Andy came over to me. And then the crowd, a standing ovation, just roaring. And I'm trying to do my interview, and I can't hear myself over the speakers. The crowd was so ruckus. So even though I lost the fight, I couldn't help but feel like I won the war, like for the crowd. And there was live on Fox Sports too. So for the next month, everywhere I went for the next month, I'd be at the bookstore looking at a magazine. I'd get tapped on the shoulder. You won that fight, mate. Be down the coffee shop, get a tablet. You won that. And I was almost going to change my name, though. You won that fight, because everyone was saying, wherever I went, that's all I was getting. It was very cool.
I told Nate you were coming in today. He said to say hello, by the way. He's a good dude.
Yeah, so cool.
He's
so
a good
cool.
dude. So can I ask you a question? And this is a question that, this question is probably is the genesis of how UFC came about. Like, you've boxed. You've done kickboxing, you've boxed in a proper boxing sense, and you've done a Muay Thai. Which is the more lethal?
Oh, Muay Thai, for sure.
Yeah, well, and explain that to me, because, I mean, we watch UFC, and, everyone watches UFC, of course, MMA, and they all end up wrestling on the ground, which is what your son's doing now. He's doing jiu-jitsu.
Yes.
Yeah, because I've seen him compete a bit, and Dad's very proud of him. And you've got 3 kids, haven't you?
Yes.
Yeah, you've got 3 kids. And you're a great family man, but... If you just, you've spent a long time in the fight game, and you've done all of them, and you've achieved at very high levels, at the highest levels, why do you say Muay Thai is the more effective?
I'd done 12 rounds boxing for the one of the titles. So I was good for 12 threes. And then about 2 or 3 weeks later, the opportunity to do a 5-round Muay Thai fight came up. In my head, I'm thinking, I've just done 12 rounds. I'm fit as a fiddle. And then when I did the Muay Thai fight, when you incorporate the clinching and the knees and throwing legs, the amount of energy and cardio that it takes to throw a hard kick compared to a hard punch. When you're tired in boxing, you can get that second wind where you can keep driving. And I discovered when you get tired in Muay Thai, you just hit the wall and then your body just stops. So, and it's not a good place for it to stop when someone's trying to take your head off. And then boxing, you have the luxury of fighting with padded fists. Whereas kickboxing's shins, knees, bare elbows. Not as much brain trauma, but more body trauma. So broken ribs and broken knuckles. And I've fighting with elbows. I've had 350 stitches in my face from all the trauma. It's just so different to boxing. Boxing, it's hard. It's an all body fight instead of just the arm fight.
Only as an observer, because I've never done Muay Thai. I don't know about it, but I've watched it a lot. And just one of the things that looks across my mind is that in boxing, you're right, if you've got ring craft, you can sort of buy yourself a rest. Yes. You can rest. You can move around a little bit, stay away, you know, if you want to. It looks like in Muay Thai you can't, because if your opponent sees you're doing that, as you say, they'll jump all over you. Yeah. And you can't jump over someone all over someone with boxing. It's a bit harder. Plus you've got the big gloves when you can't grab them and you can't pull them around the joint. Whereas Muay Thai, you know, as you say, you're going to get copped knees, elbows, wherever.
Yep.
Is that why you think it's one of the reasons you think it's more dangerous as a sport?
It's in Thailand too. You're also scored for walking forward, so you have two guys that'll stand right in front of each other and just trade. So I have to believe in my skills that if you throw a kick, that I can bring my check up without having trying to retreat.
Yeah.
And then I'm in fighting range to counter and strike as well. So you just can stand there and you can both just bounce off each other, just trading for nonstop. It's like a boxing is a science of the art of not getting hit, whereas Muay Thai, I want to show you that I'm a caveman and I can take more punishment than you can take.
Yeah, it seems more brutal.
Yeah, definitely more brutal.
In terms of, you're right, because you have to be prepared to cop the punishment.
Yes.
If you watch boxing, someone like Mayweather, you know, undefeated. I mean, people are going to think I'm a heretic saying, but I used to find him boring to watch because he was such a defensive fighter.
Yes.
But he just didn't get hit.
Yeah.
But he'd still win. He'd win, but he'd get hit a lot less than anybody else.
Yes.
And it seems to me that in Muay Thai, you have to be, maybe it's how you get brought up, like living, sleeping on the ground and all that stuff. I mean, you've got to be tougher, mentally tougher. That's my gut feel.
Yes.
Is that one of the reasons why coming out of Thailand, you see a lot of, you know, they come into Australia to fight our fighters. They might not be as skilled in boxing, but they're always tough.
Yep.
They can cop a lot of punches. Do you think that's the reason?
Also, Thailand taught me the poker face.
What's that mean?
To show no emotion, no matter how bad you hit, how bad you cut, how much agony you're in. As soon as you give the slightest indication that you're hurting, your opponent will feed off it, and they'll try and finish their job. So you can't zero expression. That's the hardest part. And then when you come back to Australia, when you fight other Westerners, it's like it's easy to pull the bluff.
Yeah, yeah.
So
that's important. And so you now live on the Gold Coast. We're back living on the Gold Coast. What's the name of your gym?
Abunchu.
Yeah. So now, what type of gym is it? Is it all disciplines or just Muay Thai?
Yes. So recently, in the last 3 years, we've incorporated Jiu-Jitsu, MMA, boxing. I was with the boxing before, but more set now. More regular. You can't just survive one martial art anymore. With this day and age with MMA, everyone wants to broaden their martial art experience. So I had a big fight against Anthony Mundine, and that gave me enough money to buy some jiu-jitsu mats and to deck out the gym. And then we have a Brazilian jiu-jitsu trainer. He's been such a big influence on my children and our classes.
Is he Brazilian?
Daniel Almeida. He's such a nice guy, and he's like the kid whisperer. We have 4-year-olds and kids classes, and everyone pays attention. And then when he calls stop to the round, everyone's like, "Yep, yes sir, no sir." It's really cool. It's really cool to see.
Because I got grandkids, and it's funny. I was only talking to someone about it the other day, and you know, typically in Australia, if you've got kids that in the summer they're doing surf club. Down the beach, nippers and whatever, and then in the winter they're either playing rugby league, soccer, or rugby union or something like that. My oldest grandson, he's 60, he's not really interested in those things. So, and I was thinking about, well, what could he do? And I thought to myself, his mother's anti-violence, which is fair enough. She sees footy as violent. And I thought to myself, what about if I pay for him to go learn jiu-jitsu? That's not really a violent sport. I mean, especially if they're all starting on the ground and stuff like that.
Oh, definitely.
I mean, you have it. You have kids going to your gym.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. What are the benefits of something like that? I mean, and because Australia, we know you guys have brought a lot of evolution in terms of how Australians view the fight game. Once upon a time, it was just boxers. Then it became Muay Thai. Now it's UFC, etc. But really, for kids, jiu-jitsu's a pretty cool sport to do.
Oh, amazing.
What do you reckon about that? Because your son's is competing in jiu-jitsu now, but like you must have put him in at a young age.
Oh, for sure. And my daughter, she's 9 and she's in the gym every day. So every time I pick up the kids from 3, we get home, we change our clothes, we're in the car by 3:30, and my kids are not one of them ever complained that never wanted to train. They've got their little community with their own little kids their age, and they're excited to train every single afternoon. So in that respect, I'm very blessed.
So it's good socially.
Oh, for sure. And get the, someone with the same passion as you too makes it more fun. And then you're feeding off each other. The harder you train, the harder I want to train to match your enthusiasm.
But what do you think of the physical benefits of it?
I think with the boys especially, even the girls, kids are tough. Kids like wrestling. Kids like having a little bit of competition. Kids, and then in a controlled environment with padded mats and got the soft bags and the soft pads, and then just getting a sweat and having fun, and then trying to express yourself. Like you might do at rolling, you might pull off the move that the instructor told you what that special move for that day was, and just having that feeling of reward of being able to achieve, and then not getting hurt too. And then the best part is having the confidence of, I have a skill now that I know if I'm ever in trouble that I can use that to protect myself. Not that I want to use it unintentionally or in a bad manner, but I want to know that I can have confidence that if someone tries to take my wallet, I can defend myself, or until someone helps me at least. I think it teaches kids not to fight, because you learn early that it hurts.
Yeah.
It's like I'm in a control environment. I know if I don't tap, that's going to put me in a compromised position. I know for a fact that I don't want to fight. I'm learning to fight so I don't have to fight.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. And it's physically it's good too for coordination and stuff like that. You've lived your life as a fighter. Apart from your achievements, it's actually helped you live a life. Like you're relatively speaking young man still. You've got a young family. You've got your gym. I see you've got your Monster T-shirt on there. I mean, I saw you in Perth about a year ago or so. Monster. They look after you. They send you places, and
I've been so lucky.
And I've been watching some of the stuff. Like you had a lot of traveling. Was it last year? Maybe this year.
This year,
a lot of traveling. And where you were sort of sponsored to do things. How important has that been to you? And how do you build relationships with these organizations? I mean, how do you do that?
Oh, I'm very blessed. A gentleman called Hans Mollenkamp from America. I had a competition in. California, I was going to go and compete. And then 2015, he sent me a message. Hey, I want to help you with this event. How would you like to be sponsored by Monster? Like, wow, that'd be so cool. So I thought it was just going to be a one-off gig. And then since then, we've built a relationship. And then I just re-signed for another 2 years. So that'll be 10 years with the company.
10 years.
10 years with Monster Energy. They've been so good to me. Special events like the UFC and the Grand Prix and the racing cars. And then working with Cam Waters. I'm going on, what is it when they do those track days? Cam's so cool too, as well.
But you get to meet other people too, because they sponsor young Ryan.
Yes.
I think he was over there in Perth.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
I mean, you get to meet
Sydney too. He's in Sydney as well.
Yeah, well, you meet cool people. Interesting people. Well, it strikes me you're still the same kid, but, you know, an older body, but still the same kid. And it's just been a wonderful ride for you.
So amazing. I'm so lucky I have martial arts in my life. It's just kept me sane. Like I was saying, being the only child and I've always had martial arts as my focus. I've had, it's one direction my whole, this is the hardest part about being retired, because for 35 years I've only had one focus, next fight. And then that's always kept me away from doing bad things. Like I've always had, I can't go here, I can't go to that party, or I can't get involved with these people because
can't drink because I'm trying.
The direction I want to go, and if I don't want to jeopardize that by shooting myself in the foot and getting too loose, or and then you retire. And then all of a sudden that whole focus and that whole goal and that whole dream, it just stops. It's like, And then, it's so hard. It so sucks.
But do you feel as though then the next phase of your life is about inspiring and motivating others to live or experience of life that you've experienced?
Yeah, with my kids, it makes me so proud to see them achieve their own martial arts dreams. With Jazzy going to the boxing and Jesse doing jiu-jitsu, like even though it's martial arts, it's a completely different world and different community to what I was brought up with. So, they're my main goal now. But to be the man for so long and then to have it just put the handbrake on, it's like, it's done.
Do you think it happened a bit too sudden?
No, I knew it was coming. And then I got to that stage where I was 45 now. I had my last fight at 45 years old. And I knew I was getting long in the tooth. It's like, and then when you start seeing other older gentlemen, you think, oh, come on, mate, time to give it away. And then all of a sudden, I'm that guy now. It's like, no, what happened then? I remember being the guy chasing the dream, chasing the champ, and then everyone chasing me. And then, you're in the magazines, you're on the TV, and then all the international adventures as well, fighting overseas, and you're fighting in Italy, you're fighting in Jamaica, you're fighting in Japan. And then all of a sudden, it's like, the handbrake goes on.
Well, I don't know. It's funny you should say, but I do know when I saw you in Perth, and I think I saw you in Sydney too, Sydney UFC, everybody's still, as John Wayne Parr, like everybody effectively stopping you, get a photograph and stuff like that. So there is still a relevance there. I mean, I guess you enjoy it. Otherwise, you wouldn't put yourself in that environment. You wouldn't put yourself in the public environment. But you enjoy being friendly towards people.
Yes.
I mean, that's the thing that struck me. This guy's so friendly. That's a friendly dude. Like, do you put that down to the discipline that you learnt in Thailand when you were, as you say, sleeping on the boards and,
So when I was younger, I just got back from Thailand for my first six-month trip. And I remember being at the fights and I seen a famous guy. His name was Ian Jacobs. He was like a hero to me. And then we'd sparred a few times. So I had him up on a pedestal. And then I remember him walking past the crowd and I've jumped off my seat and I've given him a wave and he's given me the look. And then he just kept walking without any acknowledgement. I just sat back down in my chair and it's like, I just felt heartbroken. And I thought, I never want to be that guy. I never want to not say hello to someone and make them feel like they're inferior. So I now go out of my way. If someone comes up, whether it be young or old, or I always go out of my way and give them like 5 minutes. So I say good day, have a handshake, get a picture. And then they got that. And because it only takes one person to tell 20 people that you're a dickhead. But if you're nice to that person, they tell 20 people, hey, he was a really nice guy. So, I learned that definitely early in my career just from what happened to me. So, use that experience.
Well, John Wayne Parr, it's been a great pleasure to talk to you today. I have to tell you, you're one of the most infectiously likable people that I've ever met. But equally on the other side of it, you're one of the most accomplished fighters Australia has ever produced, ever.
Hey.
And in that regard, from my point of view and for our audience point of view, it's been a great honour, mate.
Mate, thank you so much. Thank you so much. From the first time we met, I just felt like I tell everyone to this day, you're like the long lost uncle. And then every time we've seen each other at the hotel, I just felt like we had a connection. I'm so
totally
humbled that I got the invitation to come and have a chat.
Oh, mate,
so
it's great content.
So glad I could be here.
It's so important for us. And, and it's important for me to put great Australians out in front of the rest of the audience. And you're one of them.
Oh, no, thank you so much.